Over the past couple of weeks, the U.S. military has beefed up its presence in the region. In mid-December, a U.S. Navy-guided missile submarine made an unusual transit of the Strait of Hormuz, the strategic waterway between Iran and the Arabian Peninsula. Earlier in December, a pair of B-52 bombers from Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana flew what the military called a presence mission over the Persian Gulf. That flight was repeated a week later, with two B-52s flying nonstop from North Dakota and heading home after cruising over the western side of the Persian Gulf. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, noted that the U.S. increased military presence in West Asia stems from Washington's fear of the consequences of its past acts of mischief in this region. The IRGC commander, Major General Hossein Salami, also vowed harsh retaliation against any aggression targeting the country.
We will respond to any move by the enemy with a harder and reciprocally more resolute blow. This has been proven time and time again. We say the same thing today. We will not spare the enemy and will not leave it alone.
Last week, Iran issued a stern warning to the UN Security Council about the U.S.'s recent provocative moves in the region. In a letter to the Council, Iran's permanent mission to the UN raised the alarm over what it called U.S. warmongering tendencies, adding that Washington must bear the full responsibility of the consequences. The letter also echoed Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif's remarks, who said that Iran does not seek war, but will openly and directly defend its people, security, and vital interests.
Did you really read all those books, or is it just to make an impression?
My sisters love those books. I really think you might like them. And I'm willing to be directed as well.
How much are you familiar with the books in the bookshelves of the Muslim libraries in the world?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A warm welcome to the program Bookshelf on RIB English Radio. With me, Mohammad Javad, hosting this program. It is coming to you from Iran. Well, this program, as you know, introduces books usually with religious themes. And we have so far introduced many books from different websites, usually based on Islamic background. Today, we are going to introduce another interesting book by Mahdi Golshani, which is called Can Science Dispense with Religion? Let's talk about this a little bit as a kind of background. And we set the stage by saying that, or suffice to say that, well, there is argument among people in general, and even technicians and scientists, think tanks, scholars of some sort, they argue, some of them, for religion and some of them for science. Some believe that they are separate and they have to be kept separate. But some others argue for the kind of interaction between science and religion. So much so that a scientist of this caliber like Albert Einstein says, science without religion is blind, while religion without science is lame. We don't want to talk about the truth or falsehood of this statement, but it shows how important this subject or the interaction between science and religion is. Now, let's have a quick look or a glance at what this professor of physics says about this book and the kind of relationship that they can have. Well, can science dispense with religion? First, it goes to talk about what it is that we call science or religion. You're listening to the program Bookshelf on RIB English Radio. We take a short break.
Soft Softly you called to me. Out from the space between, out from eternity, will I find a path unseen? How I was lost before you reached for me. No, I don't know where I would go, what I would do without you, without you, without you.
Back to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And we were introducing the book Can Science Dispense with Religion, written by Mehdi Golchani. Mehdi Golchani is a professor of physics at Sharif University of Technology. He is the director of the Institute for Humanities and Cultural Studies. Well, this book has been published in different formats on al-islam.org, so you can easily download it from that website, or you can also listen to this program that is coming to you from Iran on IRIB English Radio. Just search Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. That's as easy as that. Well, the whole book is divided into several parts. It's a very short book, so it doesn't really take much time to read it. And to be honest with you, it's a very interesting book, although it is very short. Can Science Dispense with Religion? Well, it talks about the definition of science and religion. It goes into details about what the definitions of science and religion are. The second part that he deals with is, do you see any conflict between your definitions of these two concepts? So he talks about the kind of conflicts of opinions, argument among scholars that they have in relation to the definitions of these two concepts, namely religion and science. And the third point that it raises is, where do you think there may be a conflict between these two? And the next point that it brings up is, what have been the grounds for the development of conflict between these two? The next point that he talks about is, what has been the role of religion in the development of science in the West? Very interesting part. And the next point also is, can we have a religious science? Yet another point that he refers to in his book, Can Science Dispense with Religion, is, can science dispense with religion? That is where the title is taken from, actually. And I'm going to read it, in fact, in the next part of or section of this episode. And the last point that he raises is, can one separate the domains of activity of science and religion completely? Well, let's take a short break and we'll be back. After this break, we are going to read a part of this book, Can Science Dispense with Religion?
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajil darajahum.
Back to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And we were talking about the book, Can Science Dispense with Religion? This is actually the seventh part or in the contents of this rather short book, written by Mehdi Golchani, talks about Well, whether science can do without religion. Let's read apart from this. Science certainly cannot dispense with religion. One. This one actually refers to the concept and the definition given in this book by Mehdi Golshani. As we have already noted, extra-scientific presuppositions are essential for choosing research projects, selecting theories, and interpreting the results. Can science dispense with religion in the narrower sense? Does science need God? Naturalists believe not. It has, however, become clear that naturalism falls short in providing a coherent worldview framework for science. For example, naturalism has offered no plausible explanations for the mathematical structure of physical reality, for the existence of a rational, causally effective human mind, or for the existence of absolute moral or rational norms. Indeed, materialism, an essential part of the most forms of naturalism, denies the very existence of non-physical entities such as minds and norms. Even if such non-physical entities did conceivably exist, the naturalist empiricism affords him no means of gaining access to them. Naturalism is fatally plagued by a defective metaphysics and epistemology that have no room for moral or aesthetic values, truth, purpose, meaning, love, goodness, or beauty. Naturalism is a truncated worldview that has no place for precisely those aspects of man that make him human. By undermining the reality of a purposeful self and the possibility of objective knowledge, naturalism undermines itself. To rationally defend materialism, one must necessarily presume the existence of rational minds and absolute norms. Since materialism rejects such non-material entities, it follows that the rational defense of materialism is self-refuting. The same holds for empiricism. The empiricist's assertion that only sense data are valid sources of knowledge is itself non-empirical. Hence, empiricism, too, is self-refuting. Given these lethal flaws in materialism and empiricism, it is not surprising that naturalism has led to postmodern skepticism. Any viable worldview must embrace an adequate epistemology that can transcend the stream of mere empirical data. It must include also an adequate metaphysics that has room for rational minds and absolute universals. A viable worldview must be able to account for science and common sense. For example, any scientist must assume that the universe has a law-like structure that is comprehensible to humans. Theism, unlike naturalism or skepticism, provides a sufficiently rich metaphysics and epistemology that can credibly explain the full range of reality, including particularly the nature and condition of humanity. Theism can readily account for the rationality of the universe and our ability to function as scientists. In short, a scientist may profess to be an atheist, but he can do his science only on the borrowed premises of an essentially theistic worldview. You see how this section ends? Very interesting. We were introducing the book, Can Science Dispense with Religion?, written by Mehdi Golshani. It is downloadable from al-islam.org. And you can also get this episode downloaded from our website. Just simply search Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. That was the program Bookshelf, coming to you from Iran, hosted by me, Muhammad Javad. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The White House in transition released two New Year statements. While outgoing President Trump reflected on what he called his historic victories, President-elect Biden looked to the future with plans for improvements such as distributing COVID vaccines more quickly. In working our way back to review Iran in 2020, America's historic victories come into play. Trump's accomplishments included frequently ignoring the severity of the pandemic and at times even ignoring the science behind virus transmission. Earlier in 2020, he presented Iran with a New Year gift, the lifeless body of its anti-Daesh general, Soleimani. Soleimani was assassinated on the 3rd of January by a U.S. drone strike in Baghdad. And later in the year, towards the year-end, Fakhrizadeh, an Iranian nuclear scientist, was assassinated. Stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today and running you through the year past. In between assassinations, Iran grappled and is still grappling with the coronavirus like the rest of the world. But whilst under the harshest ever sanctions imposed by the US. In attempting a chronological account of events, I begin with cause of the year's first assassination. Dr. Marandi is going to be accompanying us on this show. And you'll be seeing some of our show guests from past and reviewing 2020.
I think the reasons for the murder of General Soleimani are quite obvious. The Americans were frustrated that they were defeated in Syria. They were supporting ISIS and al-Qaeda, and so were their allies. And they were hoping to undermine Syria. We know that from the former U.S. Secretary of State, Kerry, when he said we allowed ISIS to advance on Damascus to put pressure on President Assad.
Soleimani was martyred after Trump was impeached, but before his Senate trial. So it was partly a distraction from White House insufficiency and offense. Trump simply mulled over the decision over a round of golf, according to Bob Woodward, the journalist who authored Rage, a book on President Trump.
Soleimani was plotting imminent and sinister attacks on American diplomats and military personnel, but we caught him in the act and terminated him.
This was at a 9th January news conference, a day after the Iranian reaction to the assassination. But how realistic was Trump's explanation? No sooner had he spoken than his own Secretary of State, Pompeo, contradicted him, saying there were a series of imminent attacks that were being plotted by Qasem Soleimani. We don't know precisely when, and we don't know precisely where. Apparently, that speculation was enough to slay the father and protector against Daesh or ISIS, along with his company of nine, including a man who enjoyed similar reverence in Iraq, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. That was the deputy commander of the Hashdash Shabi paramilitary umbrella group.
So then we saw the Iraqi parliament move to expel, to call on the United States to leave and end the occupation. And we saw the millions of people in Baghdad go to the streets demanding for the end of the U.S. occupation. And during the anniversary of the assassination of General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, again, we saw huge crowds in Baghdad on the night of the terror attack, as well as during the following day. So the response of the Iraqi people was very different from what we would be hearing from Western and pro-Western media outlets and think tanks and pundits.
Soleimani wasn't exactly your run-of-the-mill IRGC commander. He had evolved socially as well as militarily, so it wasn't completely surprising to see women with partially covered hair among the millions of mourners, or for me to see a policeman quietly weeping as he kept an eye on the procession from above, on the pedestrian bridge where we were filming. Soleimani volunteered for the eight-year war of the 80s that Iraq imposed on Iran with generous help and encouragement from world powers. Over the U.S. strike on the Soleimani al-Muhandis Company, Iraq could not remain quiet either. And in the face of growing anger, the Iraqi parliament urged the government to oust the roughly 5,200 American troops stationed in Iraq.
Based on conventions, when a country has military barracks in another country, even legally, but carries out military action in violation of their agreement, the latter's military presence will be deemed illegitimate. Then, the host nation can reverse the agreement and demand that they withdraw their troops. The U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani in Iraq violated international conventions as well as bilateral agreements. What the U.S. did amounted to human rights violation.
As for the Iranian reaction to the U.S. strike, ballistic missiles fired at Iraq's Ain al-Assad base where U.S. forces were stationed. America's inability to defend itself against the air attack or its unpreparedness was a great historical humiliation for that superpower that has made West Asia its business more than that of West Asian states themselves.
After the assassination of General Soleimani, the Americans sent us messages through diplomatic channels and we responded to them. They also sent mediators who were making efforts so that the Americans decide the timing and the place of retaliation. One of these mediators said that President Trump was even ready to lift sanctions on Iran in return for no retaliation from Tehran.
The Americans had no ballistic missile interceptors in range when on January the 8th, Iran fired 13 ballistic missiles into Iraq at bases housing American troops, 11 of which hit the Ain al-Assad base. It was a warning, and no American or coalition partners were killed. On the same day, that's January the 8th, a Ukrainian passenger jet was shot down shortly after takeoff from Imam Khomeini Airport off Tehran. All 176 people on board flight PS752 lost their lives. It must have been a natural consequence of expecting a U.S. reaction to the Ain al-Assad retaliation. Iran's military said it unintentionally downed the plane, mistaking it for a cruise missile as it turned towards a sensitive site belonging to Iran's IRGC. Ukraine International Airlines denied the plane veered from its expected course before the crash and said officials should have closed the airport. Canada's Foreign Minister Champagne actually alleged he did not believe that the downing of the plane could be blamed on human error, whereas Iran implied there could have been no cover-up as Canada's representatives had visited the site of the crash and had participated in the reading of the plane's black box in Paris. The argument for Iran is pretty straightforward. The downing of the plane was just hours after Iran's retaliation to the Soleimani assassination. So Iran was expecting a possible reaction by the U.S.
Well, the downing of the passenger plane was tragic, but I think it's very clear for any sane person and any fair-minded person that the real culprit is the United States. We have to remember that Trump threatened to destroy Iran. He threatened even to destroy Iran's cultural sites. So when the Iranians retaliated for the assassination of General Soleimani in Baghdad and they fired missiles at the occupation base in Iraq, where the American forces were based, the al-Assad base, the Iranians were expecting an American counterstrike, and the officer who shot down the plane, he made a very, very tragic mistake and a very horrific mistake. But there is no doubt that if it wasn't for the American murder of General Soleimani, if it wasn't for the constant threats to destroy Iran by Trump, that this would never have happened.
Iran is determined to neutralize U.S. hostility, Well, its parliament, for one, is. It was on February the 21st that elections for that new 11th parliament were held. And this is how results looked. 40 independents were elected, 19 reformists and moderates, and as many as 220 principalists. Voters opting for principalists was because they wanted a more decisive approach towards weak Western compliance with the JCPOA, the moderate government's pet project. There has been interesting activity in Parliament or the Islamic Consultative Assembly since, which I will be referring to later in the programme. Blocking the transfer of medicine, or the means to pay for it, that's oil money, or to transfer it, sanctions through and through. No, actually, you can call it genocide on the sly. Here's who's the culprit and who cares with corona on the loose. Blocks on medicine and or banking, so that Iran can't pay for drugs, raw materials and medical equipment. Culpability begins with the US, but the strain has carried on in Iran. This in spite of the fact that the United Nations Human Rights Commissioner called for the urgent reevaluation of sanctions against countries grappling with the global pandemic. Coronavirus disease, or COVID-19, was first reported from Wuhan in China on December the 31st, 2019. Iran confirmed its first cases on February the 19th, 2020. Those were two positive cases in Qom city. The disease spread rapidly to adjacent provinces and shortly thereafter to all 31 provinces. The Ministry of Health took action by seeing to the formation of the National Committee to Combat Corona. Iran was not alone in its suffering. West Asian economies contracted by an average of around 5% because lockdowns slowed down domestic economic activity and limited global demand. Pandemic-sensitive sectors such as tourism particularly suffered, as did oil prices. And unemployment and poverty that prevailed before 2020 worsened and is foreseen to worsen further in 2021. Most regional governments worked hard to manage the crisis, but carnage was unavoidable, given limited fiscal space. Now, Iran has had U.S. sanctions, be they legal or not, to deal with on top of the pandemic. The country has grown resilient to sanctions that have been ongoing throughout its 40-plus year life of the revolution. But with a maximum pressure campaign, it's surviving by gasping for air.
Let me describe the situation of some countries around Iran these days. Most of them don't have any equipment or device for detecting this virus. And unfortunately, I should say, many of these countries don't even have a healthcare system. They can't even specify the number of infected people. For example, the healthcare system in Pakistan and Iraq are much inferior to that of Iran. In Iran, there are many labs which try to test this virus and other viruses, and our healthcare system is able to check this virus and give report to the World Health Organization every day.
U.S. restrictions on Iran's banking system and oil exports have limited this country's ability to finance and purchase essential items from abroad. That's drugs as well as raw materials and equipment needed to manufacture medicine domestically. Talking illegal, the Trump administration has even reduced the number of licenses it grants companies for certain medical exports to Iran. It is not possible to determine exactly how much U.S. sanctions have affected Iran's capacity to fight a virus, according to Iranian medical workers and global public health experts. It is clear, of course, that Iran has been deprived of equipment needed to control further infection and save lives. Iran has manufactured much, but surely its capacity to control the outbreak has been limited. The U.S. pulled out of the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or Iran nuclear deal in 2018. The deal that was supposed to lift sanctions off Iran in return for Iran limiting its peaceful nuclear program. Yet in 2020, America attempted a resolution to indefinitely extend the UN arms embargo on Iran. That would mean tampering with a provision of the JCPOA, which the U.S. no longer had any business with. But for all its maximum pressure campaign against Iran, the U.S. for once found itself receiving minimal support. The occasion was marked in mid-August as the U.N. Security Council resoundingly defeated the resolution, leaving Trump's America with support only from the Dominican Republic. In the 75 years of United Nations history, America has never been so isolated, the then-Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Mousavi tweeted.
Despite all the pressure applied on Iran, it maintained its regional policy vis-à-vis its Middle East and Anatolian neighbors with which it has normal ties. Owing to deep-seated ties with neighbors, the country was spared serious economic harm, and the economic collapse the U.S. hoped to happen by 2019 did not happen. What is clear is that the Americans have failed in their pressure campaign to bring Iran to its knees.
JCPOA signatory China said, should the U.S. insist, regardless of international opinion, it is doomed to fail like today. Unilateralism receives no support and bullying will fail. Germany, however, ended 2020 by saying outright it did not trust Iran. Now, what might that mean for the JCPOA and Iran's compliance with the deal? Its compliance in limiting nuclear activity, that is.
No one in Iran cares for what anything the Germans have to say. What is important for Iran is the nuclear deal. If the Germans and Western countries want Iran to implement their side of the bargain, then they have to implement their side of the bargain. This is not an act of friendship. This is not a marriage. This is a deal. This is a deal that was negotiated over years. Both sides gave and both sides took.
The Iranian government may have had to struggle with domestic corruption, but external problems alone have been many, beginning with the U.S. pullout from the JCPOA to mostly just verbal compliance by other Western parties to that deal, and all forms of sabotage by the U.S. and or Israel, as assassinations and explosions of nuclear sites. Principalist parliamentarians submitted separate plans to Ghalibaf to withdraw from the JCPOA an additional protocol to the NPT, Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, that is, if it comes to it. Their resolve was intensified by the Natanz explosion and Fakhrizadeh assassination. Here's where I slip with the chronological. The explosion at Natanz uranium enrichment site was a major highlight of the year past. It was the result of sabotage and a tragedy. It caused major damage that would slow down the development of advanced uranium enrichment centrifuges. Natanz, much of which is underground, is one of several Iranian facilities monitored by the IAEA, the UN nuclear watchdog, which certified 15 times that Iran was in full compliance with the nuclear deal. That's still before Iran was pushed into mincing away from its commitments, however reversibly so. Fatality was inflicted not just on a nuclear site, but a nuclear scientist. The last of several nuclear personalities assassinated over the years. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh departed on the 27th of November, 2020. Israel is not lightly suspected of the assassination, as it had marked the name Fakhrizadeh in addressing the world with accusations against Iran years back.
No, I don't think the statement that the Israeli regime carried out the murder of General Fakhrizadeh, Dr. Fakhrizadeh, Professor Fakhrizadeh, I don't think that's speculation. It's pretty clear from Trump's retweets, from what senior American officials unnamed said to the New York Times, and from other material that has come out, that the Israelis were involved. And ultimately, the Israeli regime will have to pay a price. But already the Americans are paying a price, because Parliament approved a law to expand Iran's nuclear program as a result of this murder and terrorist attack.
In my opinion, there are two goals behind this assassination. It's a general goal that those seeking to restrict Iran's military industry have stepped in to turn their demands into an operational stage and thus assassinate the father of Iran's military industry. This has been a large-scale goal. The second goal was tactical. They seek to force Iran to make a rash reaction to this event. Basically, Mr. Trump is working with Israel to make Iran do something that would make it fundamentally impossible to return to the deal.
With all that's come to pass, non or weak compliance with the JCPOA by Western parties to that deal, assassinations and sabotage, Parliament decided to put an end to a one-way game. Here's how. Iranian Parliament is resolute it will lift sanctions off Iran or ditch the deal. Its resolution is named Strategic Action to Lift Sanctions. The 1st of December saw MPs approve the outlines of that bill. This followed a phased reduction in Iran's commitments to the JCPOA, given what President Rouhani called the E3's support for the constant intensification of cruel American sanctions against Tehran.
Well, the Parliamentary Act was in response, partially, to the murder of Professor Fakhrizadeh, and it was a form of punishment. It was telling the United States that when you condone murder, when you give a green light to murder, this is the response that you get. But it is also sending a second message, and that is to Biden. And that is that if Biden wants to implement the nuclear deal, he can do it on day one. He can give presidential decrees and reverse everything that Trump has done within one day. His lawyers actually could be doing that right now. That was his intention. And the Iranians are saying, if you do not do so, that means you're buying time and you're playing games. And we're going to expand our nuclear program as a result.
According to the 9-article bill, the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, AEOI, will be required to produce and store at least 120 kilograms of enriched uranium with 20% purity at the Fordo nuclear facility every year to fulfill the country's peaceful industrial demands. Also, the organization is to increase the monthly output of enriched uranium for various peaceful purposes with different purity levels by at least 500 kilograms. And it is to increase the number of centrifuge machines to 1,000 within a year after the ratification of the bill. The bill also necessitates the inauguration of a metallic uranium factory in Isfahan within 5 months and restoration of a 40-megawatt heavy water reactor in Adak, which was supposed to be redesigned and optimized under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. The bill requires the government to prevent any foreign access and monitoring beyond the additional protocol and to suspend the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, 3 months after the ratification of it. Once again, that is if the parties to the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers fail to uphold their obligations under the deal.
The fact is that the impacts of the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA and the intensification of sanctions on the Iranian society are quite obvious. We no longer accept negotiating on anything other than the nuclear issue. It's very natural. The other side is not trustworthy and has always been so.
That's all we've got on 2020 today. We will be back to cover events in the new year each week at the same time, so do tune in. Happy New Year.
In the limelight.
European distrust of American motives was behind the EU leaders' recent signing of a comprehensive agreement on investment with China over the urgent objections of the Donald Trump administration and Joe Biden's transition team. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Asia Times website. This article is published under the heading two-faced U.S. trade policy erodes Atlantic alliance. Stay tuned for the details, please. European distrust of American motives was behind the EU leaders' recent signing of a comprehensive agreement on investment with China over the urgent objections of the Donald Trump administration and Joe Biden's transition team. Washington's restrictions on trade and investment with China, Europeans believe, provide pretext for dodgy deals that favor U.S. companies at the expense of competitors on the other side of the Atlantic. The Trump administration, of course, has long been in a trade war with Beijing, and there have been numerous news reports that Biden's advisors had let European officials know they hoped for a delay that would give the new administration time to chime in before finalization of the pact. Matt Pottinger, deputy national security advisor to Trump, issued a statement saying, "Leaders in both U.S. political parties and across the U.S. government are perplexed and stunned that the EU is moving towards a new investment treaty right on the eve of a new U.S. administration. Europe has ignored the pressure because Washington isn't fighting a war, but rather is talking war while American companies work out their side deals with China." One cause of European rancor, the Financial Times reported on December 24th, is that U.S. authorities grant exceptions to American companies trading with China while denying them to Europeans. European tech executives and diplomats are accusing the U.S. of using its sanctions regime to shut them out of the Chinese market while offering exemptions for American companies, the newspaper reported. Over the past 2 years, the U.S. has imposed aggressive sanctions on Chinese companies such as Huawei and, as of Friday, the chipmaker SMIC, which have prevented them from buying most U.S.-made technologies. The Financial Times quoted an unnamed European senior executive as saying the sanctions had created an America-first trade policy. So far, U.S. companies have been given licenses to supply Huawei, while European suppliers cannot. Many European businesses that produce chips and chip-making equipment are affected by American sanctions because they rely on U.S. intellectual property. A second European tech executive complained of having once been stopped from supplying components to Chinese buyers because of suspicions that they could be used for military purposes, but the market for the components was quickly filled by U.S. vendors selling through middlemen. Trade restrictions always provide opportunities for special treatment of politically connected, regardless of which party is in power, as the Wall Street Journal observed in a December 28 editorial. As Mr. Trump's tariffs began to bite, Congress sent hundreds of letters to the U.S. Special Trade Representative, supporting specific tariff exclusions. Despite U.S. sanctions, there is no shortage of computer chips in China, which expects to install 10 million 5G base stations by 2024. Huawei has limited access to the top-of-the-line chips that power high-end smartphones, with transistor gate width of 7 nanometers or less, but it doesn't need them for its mobile broadband infrastructure. The U.S. sanctions have nuisance value for Huawei, but haven't stopped the Chinese broadband juggernaut. Sales of American chip design and testing software to Chinese customers boomed during 2020, as there are reports in December 24th analysis, the tech war that isn't. Cadence, one of the top three American firms, doubled its Chinese sales during the third quarter. Although the Commerce Department banned sales to Huawei's high silicon chip design subsidiary, Chinese startups staffed by former top engineers for the American design firms, and in some cases funded by the American firms, have hired Huawei engineers to produce the same designs under a different corporate logo. China is the world's biggest market for chip design, and American firms can't maintain their lead without selling to China. No American firm manufactures telecom infrastructure. The Trump administration declined to mobilize American resources to create a competitor to Huawei, and also refused to put money behind the number two telecom equipment maker, Sweden's Ericsson. The Trump administration wasn't offering any such incentives, a fatal mistake, given the cold shoulder by Cisco. Kudlow then started listening to the software industry, which claimed that fancy coding could turn generic computer components into an alternative to Huawei. He enthused to Wall Street Journal, Dell and Microsoft are now moving very rapidly to develop software and code capabilities that will in fact replace a lot of the equipment. To quote Michael Dell, software is eating the hardware in 5G. To a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And to software companies, the solution to every problem looks like a million lines of code, especially if the federal government provides $1 billion subsidy. That is what the Software Industry Coalition, the Open Radio Access Network, is demanding from the federal government. It's one of the worst ideas to pass muster in American industry since New Coke, as Cressel explained. No one knows if it will work. Software might substitute for the sophisticated custom chips that filter out the signal from the noise in ultra-high-speed 5G transmissions, but they might not. It will take about 5 years to find out, according to industry experts, and the debugging and testing of billions of lines of code probably would take another 2 years. Network security has been the Trump administration's stated concern about Huawei 5G networks, but an open access system with thousands of access points offers countless opportunities for malign actors. Worst of all, the software solution only handles the routing of information once it is transmitted from a base station to a central network. The 5G applications for the Internet of Things, including autonomous vehicles and self-programming industrial robots, require greater computing power in the base station itself to allow the 5G network to communicate with client machines. There are a couple of small-scale test projects for O-RAN approach in Europe, but European telecom experts view the software-based solution as another feckless American welfare program for the world's richest tech companies. That's why Europe in November put forward its own declaration of independence from American semiconductor technology. In early December, the EU agreed on a European initiative on processors and semiconductor technologies, committing about $30 billion of the European Recovery and Resilience Facility funds to digital sovereignty. As Thierry Breton, the EU Commissioner for Internal Market, put it, Europe has all it takes to diversify and reduce critical dependencies. A collective approach can help leverage existing strengths and embrace new opportunities as advanced processor chips play an ever more important role for Europe's industrial strategy and digital sovereignty. That, of course, means reducing dependence on U.S. intellectual property. China is, of course, paying close attention. A European diplomat based in China told the Financial Times, this declaration shows that European governments want to be less dependent on U.S. technology, although that will take a long time. This process was accelerated by the U.S. sanctions. For European companies, China is such a big market that they need to find ways of serving it. That remark was cited in a report on the Comprehensive Agreement on Investment on December 31st on the Chinese political website, guancha.cn.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is A to Z.